Welcome to the Lovejoy Hour, sponsored by Cook, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from your kitchen tap. No need to continually boil the kettle. Oh no, the water is kept hot through vacuum, so it's energy efficient. I don't really understand that. I think I missed that lesson at school, but I know it works because mine does. Hot water, 100 degree boiling hot water straight from my tap constantly. Thanks to Cooker for sponsoring this podcast. Today's Lovejoy Hour is a conversation with Britta Fernandez-Schmidt, who writes and speaks publicly about the challenges women face all over the world in the context of poverty and conflict. She's originally from Germany. Britta went to school in Venezuela and has throughout her career worked with women from many countries around the world. She now lives in the UK. She also works with Women for Women International, who helps women survivors of war rebuild their lives. She's also recently written a book called Fears to Fierce, A Woman's Guide to Owning Her Power. Let's meet her. Here's Britta Fernandez-Schmidt. Hi, Britta. Thank you very much for joining me today. How are you?
I'm really good, Tim. Thank you so much for having me.
How's the pandemic for you? How have you been finding that?
Loaded question. Not great. I'm going to be really honest. I'm getting to the end of my patience, and I just want to be able to see people in real life. And so that's in a snapshot. I mean, the first lockdown, I had both my daughters come home, and then this last lockdown, they were both away. And so it's been very different. And obviously I brought out my book in the last few months, and that's been exciting and has kept my mind busy, which has been good. But yeah, can't wait.
Exactly the same thing happened to me. I had my two daughters there at university now, but they were with me for the first pandemic, and it all felt okay because we're all together. And then when they disappeared off, it was suddenly a bit strange. Let's get into talking about your book in a minute. But first of all, I think it'd be good that we could find out a bit about you. So can you tell us a quick history? I mean, I've said in the intro that you were born in Germany and you went to school in Venezuela, but can you expand on that for me, please?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was born in Germany and moved to Venezuela when I was 15. My parents were both teachers and they wanted an adventure. And so my father got offered a job in the German school in Caracas. And that's how I ended up there. And obviously not really wanting to go, right, Tim? Because I mean, I had 15-year-old daughters now. And I was like, what are you doing to me? You know, I had all my friends and I'm really tall, and boys were starting to be, you know, tall enough. But finally, and then they moved me to Venezuela. But obviously it was a totally life-changing moment and really changed my life and kind of put me on the path that I am on still now. And that was really because I witnessed poverty firsthand and saw how it impacts women disproportionately. And it kind of awoke this huge passion to try and do something about that. And from there, I went to university in the UK, and then decided to pursue that passion and find work in the not-for-profit sector. And that's kind of taken me to various organizations. And then 12 years ago, I was asked to set up Women for Women International in the UK. And that's what I've been doing over the last 12 years. And then a couple of years ago, I started also coaching. And so just really following my passion, helping women in particular, but obviously just humans, to unfold their potential and follow their fears, which is, you know, the power within.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. So tell us about Women for Women International. What is that?
Women for Women International is an organization that helps women in countries affected by extreme poverty and conflict. So countries like Afghanistan, Northern Iraq, South Sudan, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. So, you know, countries that we will normally hear about in the news because of the conflict and the kind of implications. And what we do is we support the women who are often bear the brunt of the conflict and are also the ones who keep families going and keep communities together. And what we do is we implement a year-long program that's really practical and is aimed at helping women learn new skills, earn and sustain an income, be more healthy, and know about their rights and have social networks to break the isolation that many of them will experience as a result of the conflict.
Why is it women who take the majority of the impact? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so I mean, there are a few statistics. So worldwide, 70% of the poorest are women. And also about 80% of people affected by conflict are women and children. And that obviously is because societies are, you know, have very unequal gender relations that see women often as second-class citizens or as property of men. And so one of the things that that we see a lot is that women are being used as weapons in war, basically, and being, you know, mass raped and experience significant violence. And obviously women are also, you know, don't go to school. Often boys are given preferential treatment. And I mean, it's a whole kind of interlinked, you know, series of things that happen as a result of these gender stereotypes that I think we also obviously see in the UK. You know, this is no different. It's just the extent to which gender inequality affects you is, of course, layered on if you are in a country by, you know, that's affected by extreme poverty. And if you're then in a country affected by conflict, you know, you really are looking at those people who are at greatest risk of being left behind from any international development agendas are women. And that's why.
And is it the women who pick up the pieces as well when the war comes to an end, if it does, or the conflicts come? Right.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I tell one of the stories in my book, and, you know, women are the ones who keep going, and they, you know, make sure that children have food, and they make sure that in many places that actually communities start talking to each other again. They're often at the heart of driving peace processes because I guess they, you know, they care so much about their families and they see people dying unnecessarily the whole time. And they, I guess, tap into the instinct for caring and nurturing. Even though I think, you know, and it's really important to say that obviously men can have those instincts too. Mm. But because, you know, it's very much playing into the gender stereotypes. But that is the reality. And in order to change those stereotypes, obviously it's a big effort, and it can be done. And we work with men in the countries where we operate, and men are often, once they understand themselves that they are also in these gender stereotypes and these roles that limit their lives too, once they understand that, they become real advocates, and they work with other men in the community to support women. Because the thing is, right, when we invest in women, we invest in the whole community. And as long as we live in a society where women are systematically treated as second-class citizens and experience violence, then none of us, I believe, can really feel that we've done our work, that we've contributed to living a society that is equal and you know, and prosperous. So,
we'll get on to Britain in a minute, because I think that's interesting, and I assume your book's mainly aimed at people over here in America. But a couple of things that I've noticed in the world, interesting. I was in Vietnam I'm so bad with dates, but this has got to be way over 20 years ago. So it was 20 years after the end of the Vietnam War, 25 years. And I was there, and I suddenly noticed that all the bin men, as I would like to call them, were women. Mm. And I suddenly started thinking, oh, that's interesting that the women are doing that job, because I've never been in a country and seeing women do the bins. And then I started looking around the country a bit more, and I realized women were doing everything. And because they'd lost so many men in the war, they hadn't replenished all the men yet. And I thought, I wonder if that carries on, that women and men are seen as similar over there because they had to take on the manual jobs, which I'm so scared that I'm going to say something clumsy here, by the way. It terrifies me, being a man, talking about this sort of stuff. But the other thing I noticed was I went to Zambia with Sport Relief years ago. And one of the things we saw was a traveling sort of like theatre group, where they would go into tribes and they would do, or into communities, shall we say, and they would do, they would act out scenarios to try and educate men to be more caring of the family. And one of the bits which stuck in my mind so much, so they're trying to stop the men from getting the money and spending it all on alcohol, basically, which is the same as over here. You know, has been a problem over here for decades, whether that's ended now, I don't know. But one of the things which really amused me was during the play, a man picked up a baby and started cuddling the baby and feeding the baby, and everyone was laughing like they were looking at a stand-up comedy routine, because it just wasn't the done thing then. I remember that hitting home. So the way women and men are valued in different countries is very different, aren't they?
Yeah, it's a really interesting point that you make about Vietnam, and that's something that I observed in Rwanda, for example, where in 94, obviously there was a horrendous genocide, which actually coincided with the kind of setting up of Women for International, was the same time as the Bosnian genocide. And there what you have is actually the country with the highest number of women in the parliament in the world, over 60%, of members of the parliament are women, which is like, you know, is amazing. And that is to a certain extent because so many men were killed during the genocide that you had a disproportionate number of women. But it's also absolutely because it became a conscious effort and a desire by the government and by the country to use that moment, you know, when you emerge out of crisis, to create change, because that is all, it's easier, isn't it? And I think it's very interesting, you know, looking at where we are right now with COVID and how there is always an opportunity as you come out of crisis to significantly shift things that perhaps are harder to shift in kind of quiet times. And that's, you know, and that's really, I think, really interesting to see. I think the shifting of gender roles and stereotypes, and so this kind of laughter, absolutely, it's super uncomfortable, you know, because we are not talking about something that you know has been going for a while. It's over centuries. I mean, I believe actually, Tim, it's part of our DNA already, you know, that it's so engrossed and enshrined within us that to shift it, it will need a lot of laughter and a lot of tears and a lot of everything in between. But I think theatre is a really powerful way, and we use that a lot in our programs to show, you know, what needs changing. Because then as you're laughing, you kind of ask yourself, well, why am I laughing? Actually, it's not really funny. You know, why would men not cuddle a baby and take care of a baby? You know, and so it's an interesting way to create change.
Yeah, you're right. And the pandemic's really put a spotlight on a lot of issues, hasn't it? I mean, because we're all at home, generally, the world isn't moving on as much. So, you know, obviously, we're speaking at a time where the Sarah Everard thing, mm-hmm. Issues has happened, and the vigil. And it just really makes it poignant that you're putting out this book at the moment, and the way that women are still treated. You know, we're talking about these countries like Zambia and Vietnam and stuff, but still there's problems over here, and it seems quite prevalent, the problems, by the outpouring of emotion from women in this country who are saying, hold on, I don't feel that safe. I mean, how do you view this?
Yeah, I think last week has been immensely painful and just absolutely horrendous. And I think there isn't a woman that I have spoken to who hasn't been affected by this, because it's such a stark reminder of what many of us feel is our daily reality. A daily reality where you, in your head, you calculate, is it safe to go out? Is it too dark? Shall I take a taxi? Is that more dangerous? Shall I maybe walk? Shall I, you know, have my keys in my hand? It's just, and I think, you know, it's so much part of your everyday. It's like you brush your teeth, you worry whether somebody's going to rape you. It's and so then you don't question it anymore. And then something like this happens, and you just realize how normalized these thoughts have become. And that's when, quite frankly, I've just been so angry, Tim, because I've made it my life's purpose to challenge gender stereotypes, to challenge violence, to create opportunities where women can be on a level playing field. And yet here we are, you know, and obviously I know you have two daughters, I have two daughters, and they're at uni and they've had their share already of, you know, horrendous incidents that's scare me so deeply. And so I'm, you know, I think the fact of the matter is when you look at the statistics, they are global. So 1 in 3 women will experience violence against them at one point in their lives. It doesn't matter where you come from, where you live, what education you've had, that is the reality. It's probably higher. You know, statistics are statistics. They only tell you part of it. The other, for me, the other side is the voices, the stories, and as you say, the outpouring now. Obviously, there have been, you know, various outpourings in recent years, you know, in terms of movements, in terms of women saying, you know, I was sexually harassed, and then me too. And, you know, it's not new. And this is the thing we need to acknowledge. This is not new. It's a horrendous incident, and it's one in many, and it is happening. It happens all the time. And we have to all together, women and men as society, take a look and say, what can we do? You know, and I like the fact that you acknowledge that you feel uncomfortable, which I can absolutely imagine that it's uncomfortable, because you know that that things need to change, and we all need to find a way to help each other to create a different language, different behaviors, different ways of challenging, you know, unacceptable behavior when we witness it.
Yeah, well, I think that why it's so poignant is the fact that we can usually dismiss horrific incidents to, we can go, oh, they were a horrible person anyway. This was a member of the police. And I think that's what's brought it home. And I think it's a real sort of wake-up call to our society that there's men abusing their power or just being abusive throughout the whole of society. And we see it, like we've seen it with politicians as well, and they keep their jobs. We've seen it with all the people that we have to regard highly in society, and they're maintaining some form of you know, normality in their lives, and it's, we're not doing enough about it. I think that's the problem, maybe. Well, the other thing I want to go back to very quickly is when I go to places like, and I'm lucky enough to have traveled a lot of the world and seen quite a lot. When I went to Zambia, yes, I felt sorry for them, but when I came back, I was more angry about the fact that we've still got such a discrepancy between wealth in our country. We've still got so many problems in our country, and it's easier to see it in somewhere like Zambia, where they had horrific HIV problems and stuff, AIDS problems over there. But when you come back here, you go, hold on, why haven't we sorted out our problems? Why have we still got poverty? And we're supposed to be this sophisticated country, and we really aren't sometimes, are we?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's, I think this idea, either way, is to think that, you know, we've got it all sorted and they don't know, you know, that is clearly not right. But it's also equally, you know, to say that, you know, let's sort our problems out first before we help others. That isn't, you know, the right way either. And I think right. We live in an increasingly global world, and that's something that I've been talking a lot about in the context of COVID. I think COVID has brought into sharp focus all existing inequalities in this country, as well as in countries obviously affected by conflict where Women for International is operating. But for me, it's not either or, right, Tim? It has to be end, because we are in a hugely connected world now where we know what's going on the other side of the world. And to pretend not to care about that, I don't think it's human. I think as humans, we are wired to care, to feel empathy, and I can feel empathy for my neighbor and you know, for people who are struggling in the UK and for people who are struggling in Afghanistan. It doesn't have to be either or, and that's what I really invite everyone to consider. You know, there is empathy is unlimited, you know, love is unlimited, and caring you know, is something that doesn't cost money. You know, we all have a voice, and we can, you know, there's so much that we can do. So, yeah.
How did you end up traveling around the world, witnessing all this, seeing it all?
Well, because I decided that I wanted to use my energy and focus to help women in particular, because I saw in Venezuela, growing up in Venezuela, that they are disproportionately affected by the ailments of society, basically. And they are also the ones who carry the brunt, and they kept and then also find the solutions so often. And so it was just, it's just like, you know, this fire that like somebody lights in you, which is kind of what happened when I was 15, and that's just kind of propelled me forward. And honestly, sometimes I didn't really know how I managed to go against the grain, because, you know, I studied women's studies over 25 years ago, so, you know, that was definitely not the done thing then. And people would always make fun of me in the pub, you know, when you like go out to students union and you have a drink, and so what do you study? And like, yeah, women's studies. And you know, after a while, I didn't even say it anymore, because it was just so boring, you know, how the way people would respond. But it was just something within me, you know, that was so strong that I wanted to grab women literally by the hand and look them in the eye and say, you are amazing. You know, just don't believe the voice in your head that is telling you that you're less than your brother or less than your colleague or less than just because you're a woman. No, and that is what has, you know, then got me into working for the not-for-profit sector, and in particular for organizations that are set up and dedicated to helping people in countries affected by extreme poverty. And that's how I was then able to travel and visit organizations there and learn about the work that they were doing in order to amplify their voices and share that information with people in the UK and in Europe.
I think that leads us nicely on to talking about your book. Though I think we need to start with trying to work out why women don't feel like they're owning their own power, why they feel like they're second class citizens. What is it? How has this happened? I mean, obviously, it's been going on for centuries, as you said earlier, but why are women regarded as second class citizens? Why do you think it is?
Wow. I mean, the million dollar question, honestly. If I knew why, what I know is that we, from an early age, from when we are born, we are identified by our sex, right? So we can, oh, it's a girl, or oh, it's a boy. And in that minute, you know, you don't just say it's a girl. It's like you say it's a girl, and it's a whole package, boom, whole package, a whole box with all sort of labels, expectations, norms, you know, how you're supposed to behave and how you're not supposed to behave. And this is me, by the way, for boys, you know, absolutely. And so you put in that box, and it's very, and there you are. And so then you grow up. And as children, you often, you know, I think you look at children and they're not yet aware of those gender norms. And they often will actually defy them, and they, you know, they won't really respond in that way. And they'll say what they think and what they feel, and they follow their fierce, you know, that kind of instinct within them. And then there comes a point where that changes. And in my case, that was definitely around the age of like 13, 14, 15, just as I was moving to Venezuela, that I suddenly began to wake up to the fact that I was a girl. And that there were certain expectations, and that my brother was a boy. And so I had to help my mom tidy the table, but my brother didn't. And I was like, what? And it was literally like, honestly, Tim was like, I don't even understand that. Why? That doesn't make any sense to me, right? And so then you get angry, right? And then you look around you, and then you don't see anyone else being angry. And then you're like, oh my God, okay, there's something wrong with me. Wow, okay, this is really scary, because obviously we're also hardwired, right, to want to fit in, because you want to connect and you want to be liked and all of these things. And particularly as women, you know, you're taught that be a good girl. Now you need to be a good girl, like be quiet, be nice, be demure, be sweet, be like all of these things, which in their own right, it's nothing negative to be quiet or sweet or whatever. It's lovely. But not if you believe that that's the only way you will be accepted, because that then means that you start to suppress your instincts, that instinct that says, why do I have to tidy? Or why am I not entitled to the same salary as my male colleague? Anyone? I mean, you know, so because this is how it starts, right? It starts with tidying a table, and then it goes on. And my desire was to write a book that's deeply personal, that shares my own story, but also is built on the experiences of having worked with women all over the world and coaching women, and understanding that this fear that you have inside, that means that you think you're not going to fit in, that you're not normal, that you're not strong enough, not good enough, not, you know, whatever enough, has been socially conditioned.
Yeah, why did your parents think that you should clean the table and your brother shouldn't?
Exactly.
But what background did they come from that they think that?
This is the thing, right? This is what I don't get, because, I mean, my mum maybe didn't think that, but and my father, you know, he was actually quite progressive. So I think it was just, it's like an instinct. I think his parents definitely weren't progressive, right? My grandma never worked, and my grandfather was the sole breadwinner. And so I think there was something, you know, honestly, I don't understand it.
Richard, I wonder if it's tradition. I spoke to Harriet Harman on this podcast. I really enjoyed the conversation with her, because she's obviously helped with the equality laws and all that. And she was there when Blair's Babes got in, which was a fantastic thing
for
Parliament and everything. And you know, if you look back at part, if you were growing up in the, I don't know, 30s, 40s, 50s, you would think, I can't be a politician because there weren't any women.
So now
there are. And I wonder if that's the thing with traditions. And dare I say it, I'm not religious, but maybe religions too. Whereas men have always got the primary roles, that you're always thinking, if you know, getting myself in a right can of worms here, but maybe maybe that's how society looks. If you've got deeply religious societies, maybe that you're born to believe the men are better than the women. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's about systems. I absolutely believe that, you know, patriarchy is a system. It's neither the fault of women or men. It is a system that we have had for centuries, and it's ingrained in how we've brought up, and it's very hard to shift. It is possible to shift because we're shifting it, right? To the point where we have more women in decision-making positions. It's a very slow process because the system has kind of security mechanisms built in.
Well, even just to shift it over here, say you wanted to get rid of, like, you know, we've got a whole royal family, and we've got which is connected to the church, which is then connected to Parliament. I mean, all these things are just, they're all connected to each other. How are you going to systematically take all those down? I mean, thankfully, with the royal family, the head of the royal family is a woman. And has been forever. And when she goes, it then becomes a man. It's a completely different kettle of fish when we suddenly got a king rather than a queen. I'm not sure how the royal family looks then. Only time will tell. But yeah, even in this country, trying to break all that down. And I don't think we're a particularly religious country. It's quite a tough ask, isn't it? People are trying to desperately hold on to their power and their meaning and their values.
Right, exactly. I think it is about holding on to power and challenging those kind of institutional power, right, and positional power, because every single one of us, we have our own authentic power. And it's really important to make that distinction. And that's one of the aims of my book, to say very clearly, you know, you already have power. It's your authentic power and your voice and your, you know, that fierceness that you have within you, and nurture that and let that out, because that is going to be key to changing those systems and structures. And we have seen that. So change is possible, but it is the institutional power and structures that we need to look at. And we need to look at what, you know, what assumptions are inherent within them, what biases, and who is being discriminated against on a systematic basis, right? It's institutional.
Mm. So explain the book then, because this is a guide to any woman who picks it up, to how to, I mean, you have to explain what fierce actually means, I suppose, to how to get your fierce out, how to be proactive in getting more, I suppose, more substance out of your life. Is that correct? Purpose.
Yes, exactly. So so first of all, also to say that I'm really happy to say that there are quite a few men who have read the book, and it was really important to me that when I was writing it, obviously I identify as a woman and I've lived my life as a woman. So it's very much written from that perspective. But men have read it and have found it helpful too, which I'm really happy about. But yes, it's divided into three parts. The first one is about finding meaning. Second one is about owning your power. And the third one is about transforming your world, which is what we just talked about. And so what I have realized, Tim, is that, so I told you this story about moving to Venezuela and realizing this injustice and having this fire in my belly, and then realizing that if I follow my fire, I'm going to be not normal. I'm not going to fit in. And so fear immediately came. Like fear, I see fear as the kind of police of the norms, right? So we're scared to rock the boat. And so we kind of keep the system in place, right? And so so when I realized that that was what was going on, I then embarked on this journey of, I guess, rediscovering my fears that I had. And so what I call my fears is this power that I have inside that is ignited when I feel inspired. You know, I mean, I don't know about you. So, you know, when did you last feel inspired? When did you last have goosebumps? You know, when something, you know, when you feel like just ignited and kind of think, was I worried a minute ago? I don't think so. Like, I could do anything right now. Like, I'm on fire. I'm going to do this. This is important to me. That's what I call my fears. And so the first part is all about, how can you find that fierce again? How can you nurture it? And I talk about inspiration and, like, feeding yourself inspirational podcasts. And, you know, I was listening to your podcast, obviously, in preparation of meeting you. And you know, it's so powerful. I listened to the conversation with the two people who talk a lot about
relationships.
Exactly, relationship. I just ordered the book, actually, because I just thought it really inspired me. And just how they spoke about organizations being made up of relationships, I'm like, that's exactly what I believe. Anyway, so this is just an example of how you can feed your inspiration and your beliefs and your values. And that is then what leads you to formulate your purpose. And what I'm talking about here is, it's not a, you know, what's your kind of goal in terms of career? You know, where do you want to end up? No, I'm talking about, what do you want, like, to be your legacy? How do you want people to feel as a result of who you are? And this is really important, right, Tim? It's not about necessarily about as a result of what you do and what achievements you have. It's about who you are as a human being and what matters to you. And then once you formulate that, then you realize actually that shrinking yourself and keeping fear constantly keeping you small is actually not going to allow you to fulfill your purpose, right? And so for me, my purpose has been to help other women follow their fears. So obviously, I'm going to have to do that myself. I'm going to have to, you know, go out there, because I know that the people who inspire me the most are the ones who have that integrity, right? Who kind of you see they have a fire in them, and they're true to that fire, even when, or particularly when, it's scary. And so the second part is all about owning your power and rediscovering the fact that you already have everything you are looking for within you. And, you know, particularly for young women, that's just such an important message, because I grew up believing that I needed to become whole, that what I needed to get was out there, when actually it's in here. And it's about going within you to get to know yourself and understand what your dreams are and your aspirations. It's this yearning that you want to matter. And that, you know, and that is what you can hold on to when you're scared to maybe stand up in that meeting and say what you think, or maybe go for that new job, or, you know, or set up your own company. That is what's going to propel you forward in the face of fear. And what I say, Tim, is that it's about realizing that you can feel fear and fierce at the same time. And in that moment, you have an option, a choice, and you can choose fierce. And that's when everything shifts, because that's when you create this impact around you, because people see you. There's always someone looking at you. And that is, in fact, the impact that you have. And that's how you start to transform your world, because you give space for others to do that too.
One of the things I just want to pick up there, it took me probably 50 years to realize this, but you talking about going inside, I had a bit of a discussion with Philippa Perry, the psychiatrist, mm-hmm. on this show. She didn't sort of agree with me, but I think the only person who can genuinely make you happy is yourself. That's what you've got to look for first. Maybe I'm not quoting her properly there, but she was talking about good relationships. But I think a real problem is if you're looking externally for people to make you happy and to help you find your purpose, it's not going to happen. You've got to do it yourself, really. You can make yourself very sad as well, by the way. So you've got to be careful with that.
Yeah, do you know, I think it's a really important point there, actually. And I think that's something that I say to my clients, and also in the book. Really getting to know yourself is is going to be a painful process, because what you're doing is you're uncovering wounds and painful memories and maybe traumas and challenges that you've been through. But if you can know that you're stronger than you think, right? Literally, you're stronger than you think. So you always think that you're not strong enough. You know, I'm not going to be able to get through this. I'm not going to be able to relive that trauma in order to heal. I know, okay, this is something that I know deeply, and I am 100% convinced. I know that you're stronger than you think. I know that you can do that. And the way that I can prove it is if you think back over difficult times in your life where you thought, I am literally not going to make it. This is so tough. I'm just not going to. And you did, because you came out the other end, and here you are. And so in the midst of hard moments, that is the one thing that helps me. So yes, it's painful and it's so true, but isn't it also the greatest reward? I just believe it is, that when we can face our pain and we can show ourselves that we're strong enough to face it, that's so liberating. I really believe, don't you think?
Yeah, I love the bit in your book where you say we imprison ourselves by defining ourselves within the constructs of binaries such as light and dark, good and bad, right and wrong, with or against. And never so much has that been that's so prevalent in today's world with social media. We're completely bombarded all the time with what side are you on, and how are you imprisoning yourself? I refuse to join any movement at the moment. I'm just not doing it. I'm watching on, but I agree, you know, you do. And I imagine this is what you're trying to get out in your book, is that you imprison yourself in these thought processes, and then you can relieve yourself and as you put it, find your fierce.
Yes, exactly. I think this is so important. I think the part of the system that we just talked about earlier, you know, is this binary, like masculine, feminine, woman, man, good, bad, strong, weak. It's like we are a myriad of all of these things. And there's a part, you know, when as I was thinking about it, I thought about, you know, it's to come the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that is all within me. I know there's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad and there's some really ugly things, because I'm human. We're all humans. And by pretending otherwise, we judge ourselves in the first instance, and then we invite ourselves to judge others all the time, like you say. So either you're with me or you're against me. You know, are you good or you're bad? And actually opening that space up, first and foremost for ourselves, to accept ourselves as we are, then gives way to really listening to ourselves and to others, Tim, right? To really listen, seek to understand before you seek to be understood, right? Because otherwise it's going to get more and more entrenched, and it's just not going to help us as humanity.
What would you say success is to people who would read your book? Because obviously not everyone's going to end up being like you, traveling around the world, you know, involved in charities and helping people out. What would be success? How do you see it? Because it's not financial, is it necessarily?
I think everyone gets to define their own success. And just to be super clear, I don't believe that purpose means that you have to work for charity. It's really important, not at all. You know, I think their purpose is about who you as a human want to be. What matters to you and how you want to matter. Those are the two questions that I would say that the book has been successful if you, through that journey, you find a way to begin to answer that. And I say to begin because this is a journey. This never ends. It hasn't ended for me, and it will never end, and you know, until the day I die, because that is what I'm trying to hopefully inspire the reader to realize. This beautiful world that's within you, that all these things, that every day something happens and you learn something new about yourself and you expand your power and you see how it impacts on others, and that's, I think, what I really hope that the reader will take from it, and free yourself from those limiting beliefs around what success looks like, and realize that you get to decide even what success looks like for you.
Yeah, and in it you say there's also a fear if you don't conform, there's a fear of being unloved.
Yeah, I mean, for me, that was the big one, right? So I, this kind of fear of not being liked, of not, you know, not being a good girl. And so there's this chapter that where I talk about strength. And I think strength is such an important aspect, and not just, you know, physical strength in terms of, you know, but actually the strength that we have within us, steely strength, that means that we are, you know, stronger than we think. We're strong enough to cope with pain, and we're strong enough not to be liked. I mean, I don't know, what about you? I don't know. I mean, do you know, my theory is that everyone wants to be liked, right? I mean, I haven't met somebody who says, oh, no, I don't want to be liked. I mean, that's kind of weird. But then there are degrees, right, to the point where, you know, it's like so, so important to you, and you will do anything to be liked. You do things that you don't really want to do, that you know, and that's the key point. Do not do things that you don't want to do, that are not aligned with your values or with your fears. Try and hold your power and realize and know that you are strong enough not to be liked. And I have this exercise in my book, which really helped me, which is kind of the 20-60-20 rule, right? Where on average, when you, in any kind of social setting, the rule is that as you enter into the, you know, room or whatever, into the group, 20% of people will immediately be drawn to you and will kind of think, oh my God, she's amazing. Yeah, I really like her. Wow, you're a soulmate. 60% are going to be just like, yeah, you know, vanilla. I haven't really made up my mind yet. Don't have enough emotion. And then 20% are going to be like, oh my God, she's really intense. I really don't like her. Right. And so there is nothing personal, because they don't know you yet. It's just, it's a reaction that they're having based on who they are. So it tells you much more about who they are rather than who you are, right? And for me, for years, I would focus on these 20% who I could sense that they didn't like me. And I would kind of try and convince them, you know, like me, like me, like me. Until I realized, like, what a waste of time. What a waste of energy. You know, let me focus on the 20% that are my cheerleaders. They're going to make me feel great. I'm going to, you know, reinforce my strength. And then let me focus on 60% who haven't made up their mind yet. And just not worry about the 20% who don't like you. And that's just been super, super, super empowering. And I think it really helps when women in particular, because we do suffer from imposter syndrome and from this kind of, you know, socially conditioned desire to be liked, to be the good girl, to be nice. You know, I think that it's different for men. It doesn't mean that men don't want to be liked, but the expectations, social expectations, still, unfortunately, are different of men. So yeah.
I'm always fascinated in the difference in generations as well with these things. And actually, from reading your book and flicking through it and realizing that I was going to have a conversation with you about this today, sort of, because you talk a lot about purpose and values and things in your book, I realized that my mum and my daughters are 19 now, my twin daughters are, and my mum, you know, she's in her 80s, and they argue constantly. My mum's a real feminist, by the way, but different. She went to work all the time and looked after the kids, while my dad just went to work, right? So she did everything. My kids are, you know, one day I said to my kids, you know, if you went on a date with a guy, who would pay? And they just laughed and went, well, you just go half, right? Because they believe in the pure equality. And I love that about it. But they argue constantly. And I realized that why my mum potentially is upset with my daughter's version of equality is it devalues her life slightly, because she's lived a life where she believes in one set of values, and if she embraces my daughter's values, it means that all her life was probably quite meaningless. And just to move that on a tiny bit as well, and I wonder if we just take a random country, let's make one up, it's called Country X, because we don't want to get involved in broad in their religions and their cultures and everything, and you went in there and said, right, we need to empower the women, where all the older generation women, a lot of them would think, well, that's devalued my life because I've lived my life subservient to men totally. Is there any validity in anything I'm saying there?
I think it's really interesting for me. Two thoughts come up there. One is change. Okay. So change is always riddled with a lot of challenge. And also to say that women can just be as much the guardians of the current structural, society that kind of keeps women small. So, I mean, it's not just because you're a woman that you will be a feminist or that you, you know, are interested in changing the societal structures. So, you know, that's, I think, is really important to acknowledge. So the generational tension, I think, is something that we would always find, you know, whether it's on gender or not, because it has to do, as I believed, with change. But I'm a believer that it kind of goes back to this kind of you're either with me or you're against me. So if you know, if you have different values, it seems to suggest that therefore my values are not valid. But, and that I think is the mindset that we need to change. So in that world, your mother has had those values and they were absolutely valid because that was her life and that was the meaning that she gave to her life. That, you know, it just because your daughters have a different set of values does not invalidate, you know, I think the values that your mother has. And I think that's a really important point for me. Secondly,
Can I just stop you there? Because it's really interesting because you've just opened my mind up. And whilst I'm on this thought process, I just want to carry it through. This is the problem with social media. Nothing to do with your book, by the way, but social media is the younger people say, or a certain set of people are critiquing the older generation for their values. And if they get rid of their values, it devalues their life. I've just thought about this. It's really interesting that we need to be much more, have much more empathy for older generations and understand that what they thought they were doing. I mean, I've said on this podcast a million times, I grew up in the 80s and 90s. We thought we'd got rid of religion, cured homophobia, cured sexism, cured racism. And it's all come back. And we're like, well, hold on, what happened? We cured it all, but we didn't. And our version isn't what the new version is. And yet we're all sort of flailing around going, hold on, what about the values we had? This is fascinating. It's turned into a fascinating podcast for me. Sorry, Britta, what was your second point?
No, but I think this is so, so important. And I know that people will disagree with that. But I just think that this empathy and love and absolutely fundamentally, like one of my firm beliefs is that everyone is trying their best. It just is. And it just is not going to serve us to invalidate the values of people from before. But the other thing that I was going to say, Tim, is that I don't believe, and this is something that I've had to contest with a lot, obviously working in countries, in other countries, in other cultures. Many people would say to me, you know, how can you go in there and impose your Western values? And that obviously is not at all what we ever do. And I genuinely think the majority of organizations that I know, really, they don't do that, at least not anymore. And those organizations like Women for International, who works with local teams and entirely within the context of local communities, the change comes from within the community. And I think we all know this. We all know this. And I think actually the example of your mum and your daughters is such a wonderful, because it's one community with lots of different values, and that's what you're going to have. You're always going to have a real rich, diverse community, and there always will be people who are going to be the pioneers and who see the inequality much more than others, and they're going to stand up and they're going to put their head above the parapet and they're going to create change. And it's going to be hard because they're there and no one really understands them, because by definition they're the pioneers, and so they see something that the rest of the community doesn't see yet. And so they, you know, it's the hardest thing. And I don't want to say I'm a pioneer, but I have felt like that often. And it's knowing, you know, looking back, like the suffragettes or the Amazonians or, you know, whatever, that they were, that it's just how it goes. And that then makes it less lonely. But I think it's about creating change. It's about recognizing that the change comes from within, and it always has done. And in none of the communities where I work has that change been externally imposed. I mean, you ask women what they want, they will tell you, you know, I mean, they're experiencing it. So
that must be tough though, when you're going around the world and people are saying, stop putting Western values on different cultures and societies. That must be, because it's become quite a big thing recently, hasn't it? That the white savior complex. I mean, that must be quite tough to navigate around that, that set of circumstances now, is it?
I'm actually really welcome the conversation, because it's super, super important. You know, I'm really aware of what I know and what I don't know and what my role is. And I see my role here in the UK, in Europe, as a European citizen, to share the knowledge that I have as a result of having colleagues and access to women in countries affected by conflict in order to influence policies in this country, the allocation of funds, solidarity in order to inspire others to care. So I, you know, that is my mission. It is not to decide how best to support women in countries affected by conflict. That is not my role. I don't know how to do that, but my colleagues do. From in the country, and they set the agendas, and they, you know, they speak the language, and they have direct access to the women. But I believe in solidarity, and I will never stop believing in solidarity. I believe in shared humanity, and I know that, you know, it's a hard conversation, but I think if we unpack it like that, and we don't mush it all up, and you know, start labeling people and putting them all in one box. Which goes back to our conversation, right? If we can have a real conversation and really understand, then we will see that without solidarity, where are we going to end up? I mean, if anything, we need it more now than ever before. So,
yeah. Is there anywhere in the world that you think of a closer to where we should be? I mean, everyone always looks at Scandinavia. I'm a big fan of Scandinavia. They seem to have more equality than anywhere else. Am I right in that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, that's what I always think about. And I think the key is, you know, how I always think about this, you know, how is change created? And so this maybe goes back to your earlier questions. I felt like I wasn't able to fully say, like, where did patriarchy come from? You know, that is a huge question.
Yeah, but what sorry about that.
Is, you know, how, no, I love it. It's great. But it's like, how is change created? That is something that I think about all the time. And obviously, you know, my book takes the approach of change starts with you as the individual, 100%, right? Your mindset, getting to know yourself, your biases, your assumptions, your beliefs, but then it moves to institutions and to the community and looking at what communal beliefs do we hold, right? What institutional beliefs have created the kind of structures that we have right now. And how do we, which is a similar process to the one where you change on yourself. And that is where people join together and they question. And that's when you change laws and you change institutional processes and structures. And I think that is what, obviously I'm not an expert, but what I see has happened in a lot of Scandinavian countries is that they have really looked at the underlying assumptions of the systems that govern their societies, and they've gone about changing them, radically changing them, not being scared that this is going to rock the boat, that this is going to, you know, mean that some people will lose positional power, but everybody is going to gain authentic power, because we will live in a society where we are all more able to tap into our full potential, right?
When you say they, I wonder if they means in Scandinavian societies, I wonder if it means women being empowered enough to take on the men, or I wonder if it is men having able to open up enough to visualize a future to make it more equal. Where do you think it happened in their societies?
I think it's both. I think there are a lot of men who are very aware of how limiting the gender roles that they inhabit are also. And that's why we talk a lot about male allies and the fight for gender equality isn't a women's issue, right? And so I think that obviously the only way we are going to change this is if we work together and if we understand that the benefits will be for us all.
And that is 100%. I've got a lot of friends in Scandinavia. It works for everyone. And that's why I think people don't realize. I think men out there think they're going to lose something. And I it's just society gets better. That's all that happens, I think. What is the future you envision? What is the future you would love to see happen? Just say, let's talk Britain, because it's just easier.
Oh, Gosh, so just small questions here, right? I mean, I love it. So I'm just going to continue on the subject that we spoke about. My wish is that we, every time we find ourselves with hate in our hearts and the desire to belittle someone else and to negate, that we stop for a moment and we look at the person as a human being and we understand where they come from, why they formed the beliefs and the values that they have, and we ask them, tell me more, I want to understand. And we create an environment where you understand more and where you can also explain yourself more, rather than immediately becoming entrenched and accusatory, and where we understand that this process of educating ourselves and creating change is hard. Change is hard. But if we can do it together, then it is possible. But the only way it's going to be is if we have dialogue. We have, you know, I've just started to be an advisor for an organization called Compassion in Politics. Honestly, for me, it's all about empathy, compassion, love, and treating, you know, the people you engage with in the way that you treat yourself. And this is at the heart of it, Tim. This is one of the reasons, you know, that was a big breakthrough for me, is to realize how I speak to myself. This was a time when I was being bullied, and I realized how I was blaming myself for the fact that I was being bullied, how I just giving myself such a hard time and just putting myself down and talking to myself in ways that I would never speak to my worst enemy, literally not to my worst enemy. And it made me realize, you know, that, and now obviously I'm so aware of it, and I see people and I interact with people, and I know, I can tell you immediately, this person is vicious to herself or himself. You can just tell. And if you're vicious to yourself, well, obviously you're going to be vicious to others. I mean, it's kind of like, you know,
when you look at the outpouring on social media, you have to realize that, I mean, it's the worst it can ever be at the moment, the pandemic, but people are suffering. So they are trying to outpour their emotions via that. And it's not going to work. It doesn't work. It just makes you more angry. But people are doing that. I reckon I could talk to you for about 2 or 3 hours about all this stuff, but we're coming to the end of the hour. I must point out, by the way, in the book, that not only is it's a great read, but there's practical ways of ways of changing your life all the way through it. And I want to say jobs, but that's wrong.
Exercises,
that's the word. There's exercises all the way through it. So, you know, it's a great read. I recommend that. Can I just finish on a couple of questions? What's the one piece of advice that has been invaluable to your life?
Do you know, one piece of, as I was preparing for your podcast, I thought about this. Someone said to me once, you know, this, sometimes you feel so uncomfortable and you feel this pain within you, and to think of those as growing pains. You know, when you like a butterfly, but the cocoon is getting so tight, it's no longer comfortable, but you're not yet a butterfly. You're in this in-between stage as you're growing from the inside. And thinking of that as growing pains has really helped me to get through tough moments, because I kind of think, okay, I'm growing. I'm soon going to be a butterfly. It's all going to be worth it. You know, so that's just been a great piece of advice.
That, you know, that's such great advice. You're making me think so much, Brisa, because someone asked me the other day how I gave up smoking. It was 20 years ago I gave up smoking. And I said, I turned to, rather than hating the pangs, I enjoyed them. And we're like, come on, bring them on. Let's enjoy these pangs. And that little switch in your head, if you start enjoying them, then you're, come on, when's the next one? Give me another one. And then it just changes it. What's the meaning of life? Final question.
I love that question. You know what? The other day I run. So I run every morning. It's my thing. And I stopped and I looked at this beautiful tree. And I suddenly knew, you know what? The meaning of life is only ever going to be the meaning that you give it.
Okay.
And it was just like, you know, we want our lives to be meaningful. And it's only ever going to be as meaningful as you make it. And that is just so powerful. I mean, I'm like, yeah, So that's it.
I love it. Great way to end. Your book, Fears to Fierce, is out now. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Lovejoy Hour is written and presented by Tim Lovejoy, produced by Blake Fellows, and sponsored by Quooker. If you want to get in touch, email lovejoyhour@gmail.com, or you can find Tim on Twitter and on Instagram.